The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
All right, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. You just listened to G.I. Jive, a hit song in 1944 when Kurt Vonnegut, at 21 years old, joined the United States Army. We're here to celebrate his 100th birthday. In case you haven't noticed, he's on the wall out there of famous UUs, and he did attend UU services. And maybe why he's a UU, I take this quote from an interview he gave in 1970. The interviewer said, "In some of your books, especially The Sirens of Titans and Slaughterhouse-Five, there's a serious notion that all moments in time exist simultaneously, which implies that the future can't be changed by an act of will in the present. How does a desire to improve things fit with that?" Kurt Vonnegut: "You understand, of course, that everything I say is complete horse blank." Interviewer: "Of course." Vonnegut: "Well, we do live our lives simultaneously. That's a fact. You are here as a child and as an old man. I recently visited a woman who has Hodgkin's disease. She has somewhere between a few months and a couple of years to live, and she told me that she was living her life simultaneously now, living all the moments of it." Interviewer: "That seems paradoxical." "That's because what I said to you is complete horse crap. But it's useful, comforting sort of horse crap. You see, that's what I object to about preachers. They don't say anything to make anybody happier, when there are all these neat lies you can tell people. And everything is a lie, because our brains are two big computers and we can't get very high grade truths out of them. But as far as improving the human condition goes, our minds are certainly up to that." That, I think, explains his views on religion. We'll light this, first we'll light the chalice. And I take another great, one of my favorite quotes from Kurt Vonnegut, which we'll see later in the service, in the music. He says, "I say in speeches that a plausible mission of artists is to make people appreciate being alive, at least a little bit. I am then asked, has any artist actually pulled that off? And I reply, the Beatles did." And I light this lamp, may peace be with us. And Anne would also like to make a statement.
So today is Transgender Day of Remembrance. It's an annual observance on November 20th that honors the memory of the transgender people whose lives were lost in acts of anti-transgender violence. Transgender Day of Remembrance was started in 1999 by transgender advocate Gwendolyn Ann Smith as a vigil to honor the memory of Rita Hester, a transgender woman lost to violence since Hester's death, and began an important tradition that has become the annual Transgender Day of Remembrance. Said Gwendolyn Smith, "I am no stranger to the need to fight for our rights, and the right to simply exist is first and foremost. With so many seeking to erase transgender people, sometimes in the most brutal ways possible, it is vitally important that those we lose are remembered and that we continue to fight for justice." So in the past, we've had services on this day, and we read the names of all those people who were lost during the most recent year. So this year there were 32 people killed so far in the United States alone. I'm going to read the name of one person who lived near us. She lived in Chester, Pennsylvania. Her name was Mia Love Parker. She was a black trans woman. She was killed on April 1st, and she was 25 years old. So I'm going to light this candle to remember all of them, but particularly her.
Thank you, Ann. To go with that Vonnegut quote, stand as you are willing as able as we sing a sing-along. The words will appear on the screen.
Something else happy, we're going to all sing happy birthday to Kurt Vonnegut. He's no longer with us, but he would have been 100 this month.
Well, we have a two-part sermon. If you may have a quote near you, hold on to that on a little strip of paper. That's going to come in handy later. A quote from Kurt Vonnegut. Well, I am so pleased to be up here today to celebrate someone who has brought joy in my life. There are many things to be upset about. And maybe I think it's a good thing to recognize things that give us joy. We are actually hardwired. Our brains are hardwired by evolution to look for negativity and problems, or otherwise our species would not have survived. And I tend to be a pessimist, those who know me. But a few writers have brought me joy. And one that has maybe brought me the most joy is Kurt Vonnegut. There's often a line that every teenage boy discovers Kurt Vonnegut and falls in love with his writing for the rest of his life. I have read every book, article, collection of letters he has written. I have about 30 of his books. I even bought a book that was called literally Sucker's Portfolio, knowing that if you put Kurt Vonnegut's name on it, I would buy it because it was basically notes he had left when he died. But I'm going to buy it because it's Kurt Vonnegut. I even bought a book of his drawings that was he did off of napkins and so forth. But one of the reasons I love Kurt Vonnegut is his humor, his wit, and his compassion. I think of him as the 20th century's Mark Twain. A friend recalled after Vonnegut died in an accident in 2007 that Vonnegut really wanted this role, that he used to go watch Hal Holbrook play Mark Twain on Broadway. Hal Holbrook would wear that white Mark Twain suit and smoke a cigar and talk about life on the Mississippi. And he said, Kurt Vonnegut would just watch this play over and over and just sit there and sigh. he wanted that role. And to show off his humor, which a scene he wrote in the 1986 Rodney Dangerfield movie called Back to School, here's a short clip of Kurt Vonnegut in this movie. If we can cue that up.
I'm taking you out. We're going to celebrate. We're having a party.
Oh, no, Dad. That's really nice. But, you know, I'm in training now. We got a big meet coming up against Northern, so.
We'll have a party after the meet.
Dad, why don't you join me in a little reality break, okay? Just because you're in love with Dr. Turner, that does not mean you're going to pass her course. And you've got a major paper coming up on Kurt Vonnegut. You haven't even read any of the books.
I tried. I don't understand a word of it.
So how are you going to write the paper then, huh?
Hi, I'm Kurt Vonnegut. I'm looking for Thornton Mellon.
You want to come in? Dad?
I enjoyed reading that, Susan.
Thanks.
Nice improvement, thank you.
Diane, why'd you fail me?
I didn't, Thornton. You failed me.
What is it, because of last night?
No. I can accept the fact that you're completely regressed emotionally. But you're not going to pass my course by turning in someone else's work.
What do you think? Someone else wrote this?
Look, all I know is that you didn't, and that's what disappoints me. Tell you something else, whoever did write it doesn't know the first thing about Kurt Vonnegut.
And another thing, Vonnegut, I'm going to stop payment on the check. What?
Just a little biography, biographical information on Kurt. Kurt Vonnegut was born in the Midwest and studied chemistry in college. Because he tested well during World War II, the Army used to give you an IQ test, he was assigned to be an infantry scout. Now, he was assigned to the new 106th Division, which was full of undertrained men, and quickly sent to Europe in 1944. They were in the winter of 1944. Unfortunately, the 106th Division was sort of set out almost in a salient, almost sticking out in the line. Well, Kurt Vonnegut was right there when the Germans lost the Battle of the Bulge counteroffensive in 1944. Him and his scouts, as he tells it, were in a trench with their bayonets fixed and whatever, and he was thinking, what's my bayonet going to do against these tanks that are coming? And he was quickly captured by the Germans. He was sent to a prisoner of war camp, and during that prisoner of war experience, he often writes of how hungry he was, but he experienced something that would affect him very much as a writer and as a person. He was transferred to a factory in Dresden, Germany. Dresden was thought of as a little, you know, sort of town that had no real strategic significance. But by 1945, the 8th Air Force and Bomber Command of the British had basically were working down a list of bombing every place that they could, and Dresden was next on the list. Dresden was firebombed by Bomber Command of the British with napalm on a night raid in February 1945. It was one of the most horrific air raids of the war. Vonnegut and the American POWs that were there were sent to a meat locker during the battle. It was in Slaughterhouse 5. They were working in a slaughterhouse, which would be the name of his most famous novel. They survived. Vonnegut came out of this and saw, and what he saw terrified him. He had the job with his other POWs of burying the bodies of the civilians killed. He often spoke of coming to a home where a young family was all sitting up dead. They didn't seem to be touched, burnt or anything. They were just sitting there dead. What had happened was the fire had been so hot that it had burned up all the oxygen in the air and they had asphyxiated. Vonnegut's job then was to give them, quote unquote, what he says, Viking funerals, which was just with flamethrowers burning the bodies. This would appear, and I think he bottled this up and he tried to write about it in Slaughterhouse 5, if those of you may have read that book. It's about that, but he tries to deal with it in a way like that quote I mentioned earlier, to try and think, well, maybe things are happening simultaneously. I don't know that he really believed it. Maybe those people are still alive in another time and everything's going on at once. But at least he thought it was a comforting way to think of things after such horror. When Vonnegut got home, he worked at a few jobs in General Electric and sold Saab cars before he got into writing at the age of 30. Now, Vonnegut has always been hard to categorize. He started writing it was more traditional science fiction, and his earliest books like Player Piano read more like science fiction. But he quickly was using science fiction to talk about deeper things. One thing that Vonnegut believed, I think you could say in his writings, is that he did not believe in free will. He was a determinist. Now, I don't know if I agree with him, but he felt that we would be better off if we had more forgiveness and compassion for others and didn't get mad at them, as we often do, and myself included, if we realized maybe circumstances push people towards certain things. Another thing he did and he believed in was that one of the big problems in modern world is we're too darn lonely. And he said this was because of the death of the extended family. In his novel Slapstick, everyone in America gets assigned a family, gets assigned another name. And they have picnics and barbecues and so forth that they can go to because maybe that would deal with our loneliness. Now, this is why when Vonnegut clearly did not believe in a personal God and was awarded Humanist of the Year at one point, but he did attend UU services. It was for the community of it. That was what it was for. I mean, some of his humor, he went to a high mass of something and they sang Latin, this Latin song, and he thought, oh, that's beautiful. Then he read the words and it's all, you're going to hell and whatnot. And he said, ugh. So he went to a writer, a classical writer, and he said, could you rewrite like these nice words I just wrote and put it in Latin? It'll sound just as nice. So he had a song about, hey, look, people are trying their best, so forth. And he said it was wonderful. Now, I've often said one of my regrets in life, because Vonnegut died in 2007, there's certain writers I love, but I don't know what I would have done if I would have ever met them, like someone like Dostoevsky, who writes these beautiful novels about morals and stuff. I don't know how I could have had a conversation with him. But there's writers like Mark Twain, he died in 1910, George Orwell, who died in 1950, that, I feel like I would want to sit there and talk to this person. Like, I feel like some sort of connection with him. Vonnegut, too. Vonnegut used to give a lot of speeches. I feel like I wish I would have seen him before he died, because I've always felt some sort of like I'm being spoken to, and I feel like other people have said that too, the way he writes. Now, Vonnegut kept writing and speaking until the end. He died at the age of 84 in an accident falling off a ladder in his house. He was scheduled to speak the next day. His one son could only say that, people just loved the man, and he was inundated with appreciation, with letters of appreciation for his father and what he meant for people. Now, as Anne will get up here and tell us, do an activity with some of these quotes you have.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't introduce myself earlier. I'm Ann Rostosky. I'm the vice president of the board and also one of the worship leaders today. But I'm just saying this, we have a lot of new people here today, and not all our services are like this. We actually have a part-time minister. He will be back on December 11th. So we recommend that you come to more than one service when you're new, because, it changes quite a bit when the minister's here. So anyway, most of you should have received quotes on your seat. If you did not, there's probably some extras floating around. And what we'd like to do, Mike. Oh, is that better? Okay, let me know if that's good. All right, sorry about that. What we'd like people to do is to come up to this mic and share your quote. If you're so moved, you can add a sentence or two about your thoughts on the mic. And still not. Thank you. How's that? Better? Okay. And we have some for folks on Zoom as well, which we'll put a slide up with quotes for you, and you can share. Just, Mike will instruct you, raise your hand or say in chat that you'd like to share a quote. I'll start off just to give you an idea. And what I'd like to do, too, to move it through fairly quickly, is if we have one person at the mic, maybe the next person could come up and get ready so we can go through them without taking hours. I'll start off to give you an example. The practice of art isn't to make a living, it's to make your soul grow. And I love making art, and I can't say that I'm the best artist in the world, so I can attest to this. It always makes me feel good when I finish a piece of art. So I like that quote.
I want to stand as close to the edge as I can without going over. out on the edge, you see all kind of things that you can't see from the center. You have to look at things more than one way.
Hi. A purpose of human life, no matter who is controlling it, is to love whoever is around to be loved. Very appropriate for the song we did this morning. All you need is love.
If I should ever die, God forbid, let this be my epitaph. The only proof he needed for the existence of God was music. I really like that.
I somehow ended up with two quotes, so I'll read them both. Many people need desperately to receive this message. I feel and think much as you do, care about many of the things you care about, although most people do not care about them. You are not alone. I think a lot of people have felt that way this last year. And the other one is, this is confusing, but then I kind of got it. Live by the harmless untruths that make you brave and kind and healthy and happy. That one takes a little thinking, but I think I get what he's saying. You know, let people be happy in their own way.
But the universe is an awfully big place. There is room enough for an awful lot of people to be right about things and still not agree. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think maybe I'll equivocate, but then again, maybe I won't.
All right, my quote is, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be. What I get out of that is I don't think he's saying, well, gee, let's cogitate about the best pretense. I think he's just saying, don't pretend, be yourself. And I do know that when you pretend, I've learned that any virtue taken to excess turns into a vice. So just be yourself.
And on the subject of burning books, I want to congratulate librarians, not famous for their physical strength or their powerful political connections or their great wealth, who all over this country have staunchly resisted anti-democratic bullies who have tried to remove certain books from their shelves and have refused to reveal to thought police the names of persons who have checked them out. I looked this up. This was actually published in a collection of essays in 2005, which I don't recall there being a big anti-book thing going on back then. So I'm wondering when that quote was actually done. But it's amazing how appropriate it is today. And talking with Manny McNeil in the last few weeks and finding out how, you know, she and librarians are gathering up books that have been banned in school libraries and putting them in town libraries and things like that, and keeping them away from those who would want to ban them and all that. So there is a, you know, it does go around in cycles again.
John, I'd just say that's from a Man Without a Country, one of his last books. He had been the brunt of he'd been one of the top books authors to be banned because of language in his books and his anti-Christianity.
Interesting.
In his books, but at the time he was speaking, I think of the people that were saying, if you don't support war, the wars going on, that you were.
Yeah, and certainly
anti-America.
Yeah, certainly while he was serving in World War II, that was a big part of that too. So, great.
Self-taught, are you? Julian Castle asked Newt. Isn't everyone? Newt inquired. Very good answer. Kind of universal, I think. We're all self-taught in many ways, and It's just kind of a fact of life. Not sure what this came from, but I would like to know.
And a step backward after making a wrong turn is a step in the right direction. I certainly can't argue with that. I think the challenge is recognizing when you have taken the wrong direction to make that step backward and go in the right direction from there.
We are healthy only to the extent that our ideas are humane. First thing that comes to mind when I hear that is hate ages a person. If you look at pictures of, and I hate to bring this person up because he is just so horrible, but Alex Jones. If you have seen pictures of him just 15 years ago, you would not believe it was the same person. His hatred has made him, he's, I believe, younger than me and John. He looks like he is 15 years older than us because of the hate, I believe, that he's carrying in his heart. So this rings pretty true to me.
This is a little hard for me because I used to be a member here and I had to leave. So when Sandy and Lorraine Lee, and I, you probably don't remember me, we did a lot together. I went to see Obama. So it's just a little hard for me to, like the last one, I just thought it might be somebody that was armed and dressed for her. I call him Voldemort. I don't speak his name. So that'll be kind of my teacher, PD, 38 years. Okay, so this one, I took a lot in case we were allowed to do two, but I wasn't sure, and then I put them back. Okay, this one says, you hate America, don't you? That would be as silly as loving it, I said. It's impossible for me to get emotional about it because real estate doesn't interest me. It's no great doubt a great flaw in my personality, but I can't think in terms of boundaries. Those imaginary lines are as unreal to me as elves and pixies. I can't believe that they mark the end or the beginning of anything of real concern to human soul, virtues and vices, pleasures and pains, cross boundaries at will. And this is just one that I think he's tongue-in-cheek, like snarky, but I don't know, maybe he's not. But to me it means that you can't mark the beginning and ending of anything if you don't know, well, if you're an agnostic, which I am, you don't know what the boundaries are. And I loved it here because it didn't matter if you were a Sikh, a Christian, a Jewish person. Sometimes I get the politically incorrect names, which my kids jump all over me. But so, I mean, you just don't know. You just have to hope and you have to think that I'll do my good here on earth. But in case there's a heaven, I've got a little chip in. Okay. And then the other one I'll make very short so you don't have to listen to me anymore. And I asked myself about the present, how wide it was, how deep it was, how much was mine to keep. And I guess my answer to that would be nothing, because nobody should, like the American Indians, and nothing's yours. They had it right. Nothing's yours to keep. It's up to Gluskabi. So anyway, thank you.
Hi, everybody. Of all the words of mice and men, the saddest are, it might have been. The more I read that and thought about it, the more it's so true. I mean, there's a lot that can come to mind when you think about that quote.
course, Vonnegut had borrowed that one. Yeah. This one goes without saying, but it cuts two ways, because in this era of tribal identity, the question becomes, who are the they here? So, in the interests of survival, they trained themselves to be agreeing machines instead of thinking machines. All their minds had to do was to discover what other people were thinking, and then they thought that too.
My quote is, in nonsense is strength. And I find this one to be pretty appropriate, because I think that we often have two choices as to looking at things negatively or looking at things positively with nonsense and just, you know, it's okay, you'll manage and whatnot. And for me, this is great, because I'm trying to work on doing a lot more of looking at things in a much more positive way.
Of course, it is exhausting having to reason all the time in a universe which wasn't meant to be reasonable. I was kind of puzzled by this, because I'm not sure if the universe is reasonable or not, because when you look at science, you know, down to the atomic level, it all is, it just makes a whole lot of sense, and everything works like a little machine. So that's reasonable. But when you get up to the point of like higher mammals, like humans, it just, reason just kind of goes out the window, and humans are hardwired to be irrational and emotional. So, like I said, I'm confused by this quote.
Karl Marx got a bum rap. All he was trying to do was figure out how to take care of a whole lot of people. Of course, socialism is just evil now. It's completely discredited, supposedly, by the collapse of the Soviet Union. I can't help noticing that my grandchildren are heavily in hock to communist China now, which is evidently a whole lot better at business than we are. You talk about the collapse of communism or the Soviet Union. My goodness, this country collapsed in 1929. I mean, it crashed big time, and capitalism looked like a very poor idea. I mean, certainly like the most controversial quote so far, I guess. So the thing about like the hawk, the communist China, how it's a lot better at business than we are. For like public transportation, like I did like a whole essay in college about this, about how public transportation in America is really bad. They have a lot more like high-speed rails going across the country, so they certainly beat us in that aspect. The quote's pretty cool with the collapse in 1929, like people were dying of starvation in America and people lost all their jobs. Yeah, it's pretty cool quote again.
If you can do a half-assed job of anything, you're a one-eyed man in a kingdom of the blind. I kind of felt that way at my job. There used to be, I used to work with somebody who would tell me, who would talk a lot about where he went to college and the grades that he got, and anyway, he pretty much convinced everybody of how smart he was. And then, you know, after I was there a year or two, I realized, wow, it's not telling the truth. But anyway, it seems like if you can repeat something often enough to the general public, they start to believe it. And I don't think that's not a good thing in today's world, especially in the past few years, if you know what I mean.
I got the most appropriate one, because as many people in here will tell you, that our biggest problem in growing this congregation is we do not offer damnation. So, being a humanist means trying to behave decently. without expectation of rewards or punishment after you are dead. In my lifetime, I've pretty much handled the last part of that. I'm not worried about what's going to happen when I'm dead. But I still find that I sometimes have to talk myself into doing what's right, you know, and just not expecting anything from it.
If you would be unloved and forgotten, be reasonable. So true.
Are there any folks on Zoom that would like to share?
At the moment, there's nothing in chat and there are no hands up. If folks on Zoom would like to raise their hand and share or put something in chat, they may. I may take a moment and preempt because I'm selfish like that. I know that So It Goes might be the easiest and most famous of all the Vonnegut quotes, but having been raised in a household where things like temper and whatnot were major issues, and my own not being the best, trying to use those words as a guide to let things go and not hold on to grudges and not hold on to anger has been an incredibly important part of trying to live a patient, decent life. Still don't see any chat or hands up, so.
Yes, there are or none?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone for sharing. I think it was a good exercise. We learned more about each other, and it's amazing how many quotes of Kurt Vonnegut's that you may have heard in conversation and didn't really know who said it. So it was an eye-opener for me, have matters of the heart.
Thank you.
so we can bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. The words will appear here on the screen in just a moment.
I'd ask if you are interested in Kurt Vonnegut's religious thought, you read a book called Jailbird. He, along with the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, wanted to wear shirts, Atheists for Jesus, which was his view of things. But anyway, I'll close with a quote, one of my favorite quotes, and I think it goes for Thomas Paine. So friends, Romans, countrymen, listen to me. My uncle, and Vonnegut said, my uncle Alex, who is up in heaven now, wink, wink, one of the things he found objectionable about human beings was that they so rarely noticed it when times were sweet. We could be drinking lemonade in the shade of an apple tree in the summertime, and Uncle Alex would interrupt the conversation to say, if this isn't nice, what is? So I hope that you will do the same for the rest of your lives. When things are going sweetly and peacefully, please pause a moment, then say out loud, if this isn't nice, then what is? So I look out over you lovely people here for fellowship, and I say, if this isn't nice, what is? And to keep with Vonnegut's words about the true purpose of an artist, and the one four people from Liverpool Liverpool, England, who did achieve what an artist should, would stand if you were willing and able to sing a song by Lennon and McCartney, our closing song. You can all answer.